On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, a tough week at the UN. The American president took the podium and did okay. The leaders of Iran and Venezuela took the podium and brought the house down. Hugo Chavez may have been completely out of line when he called George Bush the devil incarnate, but nobody booed him, and the world's abuzz. Iran's nuclear-minded Mahmoud Ahmadinejad kept the cameras squarely on himself and his message with a skill that must have made Karl Rove squirm. In an uncomfortable week, we've got a compromise with McCain on detainees, bloody numbers from Iraq, fruit unpicked, and immigration unsolved. Up next on Point, a steamy week in the news and open season on the USA. Joining us today for a look at the news, two great observers. Trudy Rubin is foreign affairs columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer and author of Willful Blindness, the Bush Administration and Iraq. Trudy, thanks for being with us.
Nice to be here.
William McKenzie joins us from Texas. He's editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News and a longtime Bush watcher. Bill McKenzie, thanks for being here.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Jack, good to have you.
Hi, Tom. Hello to our guests.
Trudy, let's jump right in with you. A lot on that plate. What's got your attention?
Well, I was mesmerized by this show of theater at the United Nations. When you have Hugo Chavez talking about the devil is present and crossing himself and then saying he can smell the sulfur, and people in the audience laughing and some of them applauding, and not to mention the show put on by President Ahmadinejad, which had been expected, and actually some incredible remarks by the Sudanese president that called the effort to stop the slaughter in Darfur a Jewish plot. I think the feeling I got from watching all of that theater was that these leaders smell that Bush is vulnerable, and therefore they felt free to go on the attack. And I thought that that really demonstrated not only the bad place that American efforts in the world are in today, the problems the U.S. faces, but also it indicates, I think, really the demise of the U.N. because nobody respects the U.N. anymore. The U.S. from its side has all these questions about it, and now leaders such as Iran and so forth are saying, oh, the U.N. is just a vehicle for the U.S.
And it sure got used this week. Trudy, let's get a little bit more of that in our ear. First, some more from Chavez. Hugo Chavez, in front of the General Assembly, through an interpreter on President Bush.
As the spokesman of imperialism, he came to share his nostrums, to try to preserve the current pattern of domination, exploitation, and pillage of the peoples of the world.
Pillage of the peoples of the world. And, of course, there was Iran's president, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, there also, talking about the United States and Britain, saying they abused their power on the Security Council.
If they have differences with a nation or state, they drag it to the Security Council and as claimants arrogate to themselves simultaneously the roles of prosecutor, judge, and executioner.
From a lot of sides, and that's not all, Bill McKenzie, open season on the U.S. at the U.N.?
Well, you know, I think Trudy is right. There is a diminution of the U.N. when you have people like this getting up and just having, you know, free swings. On the other hand, I think that most people see through and see Chavez is just a, if I can say, just a nut, you know, to go to the U.N. and call the president a devil. What Chavez is doing is trying to position himself to be the post-Fidel Castro leader of this hemisphere. And for that reason, we have to take his remarks seriously and to take him seriously, even though that's kind of hard to stomach. But he's clearly trying to position himself to be the guy in this hemisphere after Castro goes on.
Jack, what do you think? Can we look at this speech? Let's take Chavez for one. Never mind Ahmadinejad for a moment. Can we look at that? Remembering the reception Bush got at the meeting on, was it trade in Argentina? Big, massive opposition there. Can we look at this and say Chavez is just a nut? Is that the right American attitude?
I don't think so. I think, that certainly was highly offensive what he said. And the response was indicative and disturbing to think that people would laugh at that kind of rhetoric. on the other hand, you know, both him and Mahmoud, we saw something there. We saw this is a plural world now. This is we are not the top dogs anymore. And these countries are going to keep reminding us of that, that who are we to be telling them what to do? They resent the whole, you know, hubris, the assumptions of American foreign policy for decades that we not a sparrow can fall from the tree, that we won't rectify it, that our hands should be in everything. And they're saying, really? Well, that's called imperialism. We don't care about it. And, of course, South America, Latin America, my gosh, what they know about U.S. imperialism. And then we heard again and again from Mahmoud about matters in Iran, how we toppled a democratically elected government there. So, you know, we're being reminded this is not our world anymore, and more it's going to be less of our world.
Trudy Rubin, we've seen years ago or seen the footage of Khrushchev pounding on that same podium with his shoe. Is this different? Is this something new?
I think it's different for the following reason. When Khrushchev pounded with his shoe, there were two powers that basically had the world divided between them, the Soviet Union and the United States. The Soviet Union at that time seemed to be on an economic upswing. We didn't know how truly rotten the core was. But at that time, there was this standoff, and neither side was going to attack the other, although there were worries about it. And, of course, we all remember, or those of us who are old enough remember the Cuban Missile Crisis. But you could sort of psych out the opposition in the Kremlin. Now, I think what you have is more of a disintegration. I thought the key thing that Ahmadinejad said, and maybe the key thing in all these histrionics at the UN, was when he said that the United States did not seem to have the political will or ability to halt the violence in Iraq. I think that's at the core here. The United States is seen as someone that has tried to extend hegemony. President Bush got up and talked again about freedom on the march and expanding through the Middle East. But it was revealed as fraudulent. And what Ahmadinejad was saying is this superpower doesn't have the power to be super. And it's that weakness that I think people sense, and that's why they laughed at Chavez, because he also was reflecting the fact that you could stand up and make fun of the U.S. now, and the U.S. is not vulnerable politically or economically, but it's vulnerable in its leadership of the world.
The smell of vulnerability in that chamber. Let's listen to President Bush earlier in the week saying, you know, the West is not at war with Islam.
We respect Islam. But we will protect our people from those who pervert Islam to sow death and destruction. Our goal is to help you build a more tolerant and hopeful society that honors people of all faiths and promotes the peace.
There was the olive branch, Bill McKenzie. What came back was not a friendly handshake. And you heard that applause and that laughter. What do you make of it?
Well, I agree with Jack and Trudy. We're living in a multipolar world. We, you know, that is very clear, and we kind of have you know, several world orders going on. But I don't think it's our fault that Hugo Chavez can get away with this. And you know, you had Charlie Rangel and Nancy Pelosi, two leading Democrats, saying, "Hey, you know, you don't come here and do this."
Rangel, this is outrageous. This. Yeah.
Rangel represents New York, said, "You know, you don't come into my congressional district and run down my president, even though he isn't in my party." And so, you know, this is Chavez's problem as much as we have our own problems. You know, this is his issue. He's going to have to deal with this. I mean,
it's his problem in that what? There will be repercussions for him? Like he may not get the Security Council seat? I don't know, but how is it his problem?
Well, that he now is seen as the guy who comes to the UN and calls the president the devil, you know. And again, he is playing to an audience in this multipolar world. I understand that. That's why I said I think he's going to, you know, he wants to be the next leader of the hemisphere. However, that's not the only world order. There are other world orders that are competing also. And somehow, he, you know, unless he wants a for lack of a better term, a clash of civilizations, he's going to have to play in these other world orders where the U.S., Europe, Asia, they just don't respect that or go with it.
I also would say,
we have a new president of Mexico coming on, Felipe Calderon, and I've met him and interviewed him. And he is not Hugo Chavez. He is not a right-winger either. He's kind of a center-right leader getting ready to come up in Mexico. So, you know, we're getting ready to have another voice coming out of Latin America.
I'm joined from Philadelphia by Trudy Rubin, foreign affairs columnist at the Philadelphia Inquirer. From Dallas, Texas, by Bill McKenzie, editorial columnist for the Dallas Morning News. Our own Jack Beatty's with us as well. Let's hear President Bush just a little more at the UN here, reaching out. He reached out to the Middle East saying, we want to bring you democracy. He reached out to the people of Darfur earlier in this week.
If the Sudanese government does not approve this peacekeeping force quickly, the United Nations must act. Your lives and the credibility of the United Nations is at stake.
But it was a big and wide-open talking shop this week. Sudan's president, Omar al-Bashir, said human rights organizations protesting Darfur were part of a Zionist plot against Sudan.
Who organized this, the Israelis? Those who organized this rallies invariably are Zionist Jewish organizations.
The back and forth was hot and wild. Join us at 800-423-TALK. We've got a call from Austin, Texas. John is on the line. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. How's it going?
We're good. What do you see, John?
Well, I just don't really get all the indignation against Cesar Chavez and his comments. I think there's something of a double standard being applied when Bush can make his axis of evil comments about other world leaders and calling everyone evil dictators across the globe. And Cesar Chavez makes a comment on what should be considered international soil. He didn't exactly come to the heart of the U.S.
Hugo Chavez. May Cesar Chavez rest in peace. But here he's saying the devil incarnate. Is that not a different order, or do you really see it in line with our president's own rhetoric?
I'm a half Latin American, and it seems to me that it was pretty clear to most of the international assembly that Cesar Chavez was saying it all in jest, although half seriously, and they got a good laugh, and he was being very comical. His gestures were comical, and I don't think it was exactly meant to be taken literally, although I wouldn't, my own views are that Bush is pretty close to that.
Yeah, I don't know. He's beaten that drum, Hugo Chavez, all around the world. Let's get a call from Amherst, New York. John is on the line there. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi, and guests. I'm begging the left to continue supporting Hugo Chavez, the very nerve of this thug, and to really, Tom, elevate him to the stature. You are putting him on a plane with George W. Bush.
Oh, now wait. He's the president of Venezuela. He stood on the same podium. It's not me. I mean, he stood there in the UN. That's a structural issue, right?
Tom, I want to know what the difference between Hugo Chavez is. You know, we always bemoan Saudi Arabia literally taking the wealth of their country and buying off their electorate. And that's exactly what it is. And Hugo Chavez, to be able to take the country's wealth and to just give it back to the people, which I guess in a way is sort of magnanimous and philanthropic, but it is very, very short-sighted. And what he has done is literally buy his way into there.
Oil has bought him a lot of leverage. Let me ask you, John, why do you think you heard that applause and that murmur of laughter when he spoke up in the UN? What do you make of that, John?
Well, what I do make of it is that we've never been friends of the earth, okay? People don't like the United States for any number of reasons, but I will tell you probably the number one, because we are the best. And I don't care what your guests will say about, well, there's the kind of attitude they don't like in the world. Well, that's fine, okay? But what the left is doing right now is they are completely, 100% alienating middle America. I'm trying to find every defense of Hugo Chavez, how he wins 90% of the electorate, when I know that those elections were rigged. Everyone knows those elections were rigged. And as far as we never hear about the free press, it is not free press. You can only go so far in that country.
Can I say something?
John, we've got the argument. Trudy.
Yeah, this is not about Hugo Chavez, let alone Ahmadinejad, or let alone President Bashir being paragons. Ahmadinejad is the president of a country that has pseudo elections, but where students are tortured to death, people are in prison, women are repressed. Bashir is the president of a country that's committing a genocide. Hugo Chavez is a garden variety populist who can pay fruit with oil. The issue is not that these are people to emulate. The issue is, I believe, that the United States used to be in a position where people either respected it, feared it, or needed it. And right now, I think the respect is disintegrating, and the need is shifting. In Latin America, the Washington consensus on how to run economies hasn't worked everywhere. So a lot of people are unhappy. Trade isn't necessarily working. Those countries that are doing well economically will want to stay in close ties with the United States. But Chavez can afford to subsidize a lot of other countries. So I think the issue is, what does this represent about how or whether U.S. can exert leadership in the world? It's not that we should admire Chavez or Ahmadinejad.
Bill McKenzie, well, our caller John says the U.S. has never been friends of the world. I mean, I understand his outrage at these comments from the U.N., but I'm not sure that's true. The U.N. has never been never been friends of the world. I'm not sure that's true at all.
Yes and no. I mean, as a top dog, obviously a lot of people are going to resent us. However, you go look back after World War II and all the reconstruction of Europe after that. You look at the way the world stood by us right after 9/11. You know, so I don't think it is that the world necessarily hates us. I would agree with Trudy that we do have to be concerned about our loss of stature. I was a little bit concerned in reading the New York Times this week that when Iran's president went to the Council on Foreign Relations, for example, and had a meeting there, and a number of people came away shaking their heads thinking, you know, if this is the guy we have to deal with, we're in trouble.
Because he was pretty
inflexible in some of the issues that he was talking about. And the reason I raise this, as you recall in the show about a month or so ago, we had a discussion about engaging the Shiites across the Middle East. And I really think that is something we really need to do, that the Bush administration needs to get out in front of this. It becomes harder to do if you have leaders who are inflexible, and it does become harder to do if we have some loss of stature. I will concede that point.
Harder to do if you don't have that stature. I want to get a little bit of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad before us here. Let's listen to some more of his speech addressing the General Assembly on the U.S. presence in Iraq.
There is no indication that the occupiers have the necessary political will to eliminate the sources of instability. It seems that intensification of hostilities and terrorism serves as a pretext for the continued presence of foreign forces in Iraq.
Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad speaking to the UN General Assembly this week. He also very tough on the U.S. I want to bring in a voice, a gentleman who sat down along with others with Ahmadinejad this week. Jim Walsh is with us. He's a research associate at MIT's Security Studies Program. He and a small group of scholars and journalists met on Wednesday morning with Mahmoud Ahmadinejad for a two-hour working breakfast, talking about everything from Israel, Iraq, nuclear weapons, human rights, a possible U.S. attack on Iran. Jim Walsh, thanks for being with us. What kind of guy is this? Is he a player to be, I'm not sure, feared, respected, booted?
Well, Tom, I think he's someone to be paid attention to. I think it's always important to remind listeners that in the Iranian system, the president is not the top decision maker. The supreme leader is the top decision maker. But Ahmadinejad has made himself a force over the course of this past year. And I would say my 2 hours with him, the thing that was most that I walked away with was not so much any particular policy position as him as a personality.
Can we write him off as a clown, a walking offense, or does the country need to take him more seriously than that?
Well, I think insofar as he seems to be at least moderately successful in his first year, we should take him seriously. Again, he's not the top person, but he does, it appears, have increasing influence, and he's not your average politician. Someone who, as in the last comments were being made, is someone who takes principles very seriously. Now, you can disagree with those principles or you can agree with them, but he seems very attached to them, to the point at sometimes of even being naive. But I'd say there's a dual message here. One is that he is sort of fixed in his views, but the other is he came to New York to say that he wants dialogue. He wants to talk to the U.S. He said, we want exchanges. We want to have flights between Tehran and New York. Just because we disagree doesn't mean we have to have confrontational politics. And sometimes it's what you do and not what you say. So he sent this letter to Bush. He's come. He engaged the public in the U.S., very unlike his first trip to the U.N. a year ago, which was a disaster. Symbolically, he may be signaling that Iran is more ready to talk than it has been in the past.
But Jack Beatty, at the public level, Ahmadinejad has got the needle in here. I mean, he sat down with the Council on Foreign Relations, and, you know, these are sort of our foreign policy heavies, and he had them going. He walked out saying, you know, you told me you were independent. Almost everything I was asked came from a government position.
Yes, I was watching him last night with at a group news conference, and he just was putting the needle into the United States at every opportunity, and reminding us of our past sins. And he has a way of smiling, seemingly inappropriately, and showing these teeth in a kind of clenched smile. But I tell you what, he's a man on fire. I mean, there isn't a cylinder there that's not hitting. And you know, why shouldn't he be? After all, we have brought to power in his former antagonist, in his neighbor, a government very friendly to him.
In Iraq, right next door.
In Iraq. We have done the work of Iran in Iraq. And, you know, I mean, that's a major thing for them, that now they've got a friendly government and they want us to go away so that they, along with the Iraqi government, they can become the new hegemon in that part of the region.
Jim Walsh, we've just got you for another minute here. Ahmadinejad, in the catbird seat with the U.S. mired in Iraq or somewhere else?
Well, I think that's largely right. He can see that the U.S. is weakened, and he feels confident. We asked him if he thought the U.S. would attack. He said there's no way that the U.S. would attack. But there has been some flexibility in his position. In that news conference that Jack referred to last night, he did talk about suspending enrichment of uranium once the negotiations began. There's a hint there, and that's a hint worth paying attention to.
Jim Walsh at MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Let's get a call from Mason City, Iowa. Rick's on the air. Hi, Rick.
Hey.
What do you see?
Well, I think that as long as we don't have a strong energy policy or improve our energy policy here, we're going to be at the mercy of these oil producers. And I think we're seeing it here. They're just putting the pressure on us. And I think they'll continue to do that until we take a stand and decide that we're going to become less dependent on foreign oil.
No accident that Hugo Chavez sits on a lot of oil, and so does Iran and the Straits of Hormuz. Bill McKenzie, you're down there near the oil patch.
I think that's one reason we need to pay attention to Mexico, which also has huge reserves. And Pemex, its state-owned oil company, has a lot of capital needs. And hopefully that the new leader of Mexico will be able to persuade the Mexican Congress to open up Pemex to some private investment, because this could help our case here in the U.S. to have another supplier of oil, so we don't have to rely just on oil-producing nations that we may have some problems
with. Bill, you've raised Mexico a couple of times now. How do you see it? Chavez has got the limelight this week, but they seem to have settled their election issues. López Obrador, I don't know if he's backed off or not, but you've got Calderón officially in power there. Do you see this as a new kind of center of gravity for Latin America, more friendly to the U.S., or with immigration and everything else still a problematic relationship?
Well, I think López Obrador is backing off. I don't think he has backed off. I think he's going to continue to try to position himself as a de facto president. Whether he'll be successful or not, I don't know. The new government takes place. The new center-right government takes place in starts in December. So, you know, there's a period in here which a person like Chavez is going to have a natural upper hand, because he's in power, he has the stage, all that. It's going to take a while for the new Mexican president, Mr. Calderón, to be able to develop his own public image. You know, he doesn't come to the stage like Vicente Fox, who is now the president, who is this big movie star, handsome leader, and just kind of had presence and immediately stepped in. Well, Mr. Calderón is much more like Ernesto Zedillo, who is the president back in the mid-90s, a technocrat, very smart, and perhaps going to be a more skillful internal domestic player than Vicente Fox. So my bottom line here is I think it's going to take a while before Mexico's new leadership really develops some sort of image and persona. And so I think for the moment the Chavezes still have the upper hand.
Let's take a call from Sam in Lincoln, Massachusetts. Hi, Sam.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
The big story for me is that the president of the United States could talk to the nation, tell them it's okay to torture people, and that he's going to continue to do it. And especially after hearing the details of how a Canadian citizen was treated, and that rendition program where he was tortured and he was
Mar Arar taken off to Syria. Yeah. So.
Yeah, and I always thought that all civil societies, the writ of habeas corpus was just sacrosanct, and to have the president of our country say that it isn't is flabbergasts me.
Even when the threat is 9/11 style, what do you think of the news of this compromise with John McCain and Warner and Lindsey Graham and the president's men?
It's just really simple. You know, if you accuse somebody of something, a person has the right to stand in front of their accuser and hear the evidence against them. It doesn't matter who it is, because after hearing about what happened to this Canadian fellow, we've made tons of mistakes. As a matter of fact, everything we've done has been a mistake. We haven't brought one person to trial. And the fact of the matter is that we've taken many, many innocent people and ruined their lives. And the president, instead of apologizing, goes on in front of the world and says, not only don't I apologize, I'm going to continue to do it.
Sam, let me bring that to my panel. Bill?
But the president compromised this week, and this was a very mm-hmm. significant moment. And I happen to think the senators are right. You know, a detainee will have the right to be able to see all the evidence presented against him, with some limited exceptions, and it's kind of technical.
Classified, yep.
Right, right. Well, the classified still, I think they get it, but there's a way that they can protect it somehow.
The sort of key kernels really they can withhold if a judge says so. But on the other hand,
but of course, the House is Trudy? Pressing to roll that back with some support from the White House. So we don't know how the final compromise legislation will read.
Before the compromise on detainees, on CBS's Face the Nation this past weekend, South Carolina Republican Senator Lindsey Graham had explained why he disagreed with President Bush's plan to withhold classified information from a terrorist suspect on trial.
What would happen if a CIA agent were captured in Iran trying to suppress their nuclear program and the Iranian government put this person on trial as a war criminal, and the Iranian prosecutor had a file marked secret, gave it to their judge and their jury, and said, convict this man, and they never shared the evidence with the American agent? We would go nuts.
Difficult days later, after a long wrangling session with the vice president's office, word of a compromise, here's Arizona Republican Senator, former prisoner of war John McCain, commenting on the compromise made between he and the White House on torture and detainee rights.
We're all winners because we've been able to come to an agreement through a process of negotiation and consensus. We still have the House of Representatives, but I'm very proud of what we've accomplished today.
Jack Beatty, John McCain says we're all winners. How do you see it?
I think the Republican Party is a winner. This rebellion by these senators was really hurting the storyline that they had built up. And that storyline was announced by John Boehner a couple of weeks ago, where he says the Democrats want to defend the terrorists more than they want to do the American citizens. And now that issue is going to be clearly drawn. Next week, if the Democrats oppose this bill, as I expect many will, then they're going to have their issue back. And so I think there was a political imperative here. John McCain came to New Hampshire over the weekend, and he received kind of a rough time up here, both from the local press, the Manchester Union Leader, which said, get behind the president, we have to get tough with these terrorists, and from local fundraisers. He spoke at a house up here with talking to people, and he got a cool reception. People wanted him to stand behind the president. I think he got the message, and I think this is really a considerable cave on his part and the part of the other senators in the interests of the GOP storyline.
Trudy Rubin, how do you read the politics of this? Polls out this week, New York Times poll shows Congress, Republican-controlled, way down, and they have the president not budging much either. But USA Today, Gallup, finds the president at his highest rating in a year, 44% approval rating. They're interpreting that as on the strength of his 9/11 fresh call on security and the war on terror. How do you read the politics as we get closer to November?
Well, I think probably those speeches did have some effect, his speeches on 9/11 and the fight against terrorism, in bringing people back to the fold. Probably Hugo Chavez's remarks and Ahmadinejad's media performance will also blip up the president's ratings because people are annoyed at that happening on our soil. But I think the real issue is how the war in Iraq goes between now and Election Day. And frankly, to me, some of the biggest news in this past week was about that war, when you have General John Abizaid, the head of Central Command, saying that we won't be able to draw down troops before next spring. There's 140,000 there now. It was supposed to have been down to 100,000 by the end of the year. Stories today saying there are no more troops to be had, and even keeping the present amount will require asking National Guardsmen to do extra service. And at the same time, it's becoming clear that the government of Prime Minister Maliki in Iraq, I was in Iraq in June, and it was pretty clear even then, the government on which we were placing so many hopes is really totally ineffectual. So the base on which we were leaning to pull the country together and to serve in order to direct the new Iraqi security forces, that base just isn't there. So I think that the polls will reflect a lot where we are coming up to the elections in Iraq, and it doesn't look good.
Bill McKenzie, how are you reading the elections and maybe Iraq? The UN fireworks and the president on 9/11 have kind of drawn the attention, the focus home. But we've got this new report saying that in July and August, 6,599 civilian deaths in Iraq, record high there. All kinds of grim numbers underneath that. Is Iraq going to come back and spook the president, or is he moving somehow around it?
Well, Iraq is still a big problem for the president. It's clearly that, and the polling data showed it this week, that most people are really not in his camp on the way things – the way this has been prosecuted. However, the issue that still is in Republicans' camp, and it's been this way for a long time, is the public still trusts Republicans more than Democrats in the war on terror. And I was talking to a House Republican this week who said that the polling data they were seeing was really kind of helping some House Republicans on this issue, the detainees in a larger war on terror. And he thought this would probably indicate that some Republicans are going to be a little, perhaps get a little closer to Bush on the campaign trail than they have been, because this polling data was showing an uptick on the war on terror. And indeed, the New York Times poll this week showed that the war on terror is still an issue that people trust Republicans more.
Jack Beatty, I'm looking here at some analysis from Richard Eichenberg at Tufts University. He says that the poll numbers reflect a consistent, persistent, tenacious effort, and this is the president's message lately, to make the Republican Party's ability to deal with terrorism the number one issue in the campaign. He says that it's working again. He calls it a carbon copy of the successful 2004 presidential election playbook.
Well, the polls don't show that. I mean, there's been a blip in the salience of terrorism, but it's still by no means where Iraq is. Iraq still leads it. The economy leads it. Other issues lead it. So we don't know whether that's going to be outstanding for voters or not. But, you know, when you look at the race in the large, we know a couple of things. The Democrats need 15 seats. Yesterday, they picked up a seat in Arizona. The Republicans pulled out of a race. The Republican National Campaign Committee pulled out of a race against a Democrat, Gabrielle Giffords, who's taking the place of a Republican, Colby, who's resigning. And they did it because the Republican electorate had put in a right winger who didn't have a prayer. So that's one seat down. Maybe there's another seat down in Tom DeLay's district in Texas. Now we're down to 13. And when you start to look at the 40 districts that are in play, John Judas has an excellent analysis in this week's New Republic. He finds that in these 40 districts, Kerry carried 14 of them in 2004 and Gore 16 in 2000. So these are districts that are competitive competitive and better than competitive, perhaps, for the Democrats. And they're in play there. And then just the other day, Chris Shays in Connecticut had a meeting in Washington where he really sounded pretty dismal about his own chances. He seemed to be
moderate House Republican.
Moderate House Republican in Connecticut. So we the Senate's a different matter, but both in Ohio and in some of the Midwestern states, Indiana notably, and in Kentucky, the Democrats are competitive in some of these seats.
Let's get a call from Buffalo. Yes, Bill McKenzie.
Well, Jack is right. I mean, we're only looking at a handful of seats, you know, mm-hmm. that are really going to determine this thing. What's hard to know about this year's congressional election is, unlike in 94 when Newt Gingrich and Dick Armey were out there with their contract with America and they're pounding this home and pounding this home, there really is no Democratic agenda alternative that has reached that level in the public's eye. So it's hard to know whether people are the Democrats have made the sale yet to say we can do it better. That's the unknown.
Trudy.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, I think it depends on whether people are more worried about Democrats on fighting terrorism or more worried about Republican conduct of the war in Iraq. And when you see that Chris Shays, for example, was backing off the Republican position on Iraq and thinking out loud about a timetable, a column by David Broder about his angst on Iraq, you see that Republicans feel the heat on Iraq.
David Broder saying this week that we're reaching a real turning point here, a kind of independent voice or perspective breaking through in American politics. Let's go to Deke in Buffalo, New York. Hi, Deke. What's on your mind?
What's on my mind is about how uninterested in democracy in the Middle East the Republican Party was in the fall of 1952 when I entered Yale. And my finance professor didn't show up for 3 weeks. And the question got around, well, where is he? And it turned out that we finally found out that he was either in Tehran or in Washington setting up a Federal Reserve for the Shah. And there had been an election of Mossadegh, and, of course, the CIA accused him of being a communist right away. And so we set up the Shah at the request of the Saudi Arabians.
But now this president in 2006 stands in the well of the UN and builds his entire address. The central point is that he's for democracy in the Middle East. That's a change of tune.
No, and he is also...
It's his father was already down in Texas working for Nixon on the Southern Strategy.
Yeah.
And it was the Arabian American Oil Company working for Saudi Arabia and to cut out and to control the amount of oil put out by Iran.
There's definitely a lot of history here. Bill McKenzie, can the president turn the corner on it?
Well, I was going to say, I think, in fairness to the president, to the caller's point, I think the president would reject, has rejected what the caller is talking about, is that, and the president has been saying, is, you know, we once looked for stability, now we're trying to move towards freedom. In other words, instead of just trying to have stable regimes, even if we don't like them, let's have freedom. I don't know if he's going to be right. It's a heck of a gamble. But in fairness, the president doesn't buy into what that guy was saying.
Trudy?
But I think the problem is that the administration was totally unprepared for what they would get in elections. We all know what the results were with the Palestinians, with Hamas. We know what the results were in Lebanon with Hezbollah. And the president actually at the UN was talking about Lebanese democracy. But there it looks like as a result of the recent war, Hezbollah may be able to push for a national unity government and eclipse the democratic forces that the U.S. was supporting. And, of course, in Iraq, the supposedly moderate Shiites, the government is weak, the Shiites are divided. The strongest force right now is a radical Shiite cleric backed by Iran's Revolutionary Guards, even though he doesn't say that in public, Muqtada al-Sadr. So we have opted for instability. And elections in the Mideast, if held freely, would bring in more Islamist governments. And the U.S. strategy just doesn't seem to have taken that into account.
Let me take a call from Boston, if I may, Bill. Meg's on the line. Hi, Meg. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I wonder if underlying a lot of this discussion is a certain naivete. The Geneva Conventions were last revised and ratified in 1949, all four of them. And it seems to me like we're stuck in the belief system that our enemies are going to take a high road when, in fact, we've seen them beheading innocent civilians on television and gleefully about this. I don't hear any repentance from the people who are broadcasting these things, you know, apologies being called for from these people. But
Meg, I understand that perspective, absolutely. But let me ask you, how do you then hear the position of, you know, the military men, John McCain, Lindsey Graham in the Air Force Reserve, John Warner, Colin Powell, military attorneys, are they out to lunch on this issue? That's where I get stuck.
Well, I think that the American people in general are not aware of how bad things are against the U.S.
John McCain, Colin Powell, I mean, he's Secretary of State, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs. Do they not know what's going on?
They certainly know their version of what's going on. I'm not saying it's wrong entirely, but I'm saying, are we giving people the whole story to consider. Colin Powell has a piece of the story. He's not the only opinion. There are equally intelligent people on the other side who would argue against his position.
Yeah, but we can see why it's a hard perspective to write off, and yet there's this effort for compromise going on. I've got another little bit of sound from President Bush with Pakistan's President Musharraf. Let's see what we've got here. This is just from the last few minutes. Let's listen in.
I'm launching my book on the 25th, and I'm honor-bound to Simon & Schuster not to comment on the book before that date.
Here he's talking about a book, but the thing that has made the headlines, Trudy Rubin, is Musharraf saying in Washington that State Department's Richard Armitage told him at the outset of the U.S. going after the Taliban in Afghanistan, play ball with us or you're going to be bombed back to the Stone Age. Armitage says he didn't say it. Why is the president of Pakistan making that kind of conversation now?
First of all, I find it hard to believe that Armitage would have said words like that. You know, I think he probably had some pretty tough language of are you with us or against us. But
the whole word's reading this headline. So what's going
on? Right. The whole first of all, Musharraf is in a very difficult position, and perhaps he's just trying to position himself as I'm not going to let you walk over me again. Because basically, what's happening is he's pulling his troops out of an area where it is suspected that terrorists Al-Qaeda is hiding, Taliban is basing, and
this
he supposedly has made
it. Yeah.
And he supposedly made a deal with tribes there. But these are the same tribes that were giving shelter to these people. And so I think that perhaps he's trying just to say, right after 9/11, I let the United States push me, but now I'm going to stand firm. And it's a real problem for the U.S. And you notice that President Bush said yesterday, if he knew that Osama bin Laden was in an area, he would bomb. And then Musharraf saying, you should let us do it. I think in reality, the president would bomb and tacitly Musharraf would say, okay. But Musharraf is in a bind over what happens privately and what can happen publicly. Mm. And perhaps he's just trying to give some view of the United States as a pressure pusher and use this as a reason to publicly push back now.
Bill McKenzie, we've just got a minute here. So we've got leaders abroad distancing themselves some from the United States here. How do you think that's going to end up playing at home in the voting? Are Americans then going to rally to the president or be worried about that daylight between the U.S. and others?
I think more will rally to him than will worry about it, but I don't know if that will be a big issue in this election. I think it will, again, be either how you conduct the war on terrorism or, as Trudy said, is the war in Iraq going so badly they just want to change the leadership.
Jack Beatty, what do you think? Space between us abroad, does that mean solidarity at home?
I don't think so, but I can imagine the Republicans making some hay out of Hugo at the UN. I think that may well come back to, we'll see that in ads.
The devil incarnate. That is, that's right out there. Jack Beatty, thanks for being with us this hour. Bill McKenzie at the Dallas Morning News, great to have you as always.
Thank you, Tom.
Trudy Rubin at the Philadelphia Inquirer, wonderful to have you. Thanks for being with us, Trudy.
Thanks.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.